WABC, WADO, WBAI, WBNX, WCBS, WDHA, WEVD, WFAS, WFME, WFYI, WFUV, WHBI, WHLI, WHOM, WHN, WINS, WJRZ, WKCR, WLIB, WLIR, WMCA, WNBC, WNCN, WNEW, WNJR, WNYC, WNYE, WOR, WPAT, WPIX, WPOW, WQXR, WRFM, WOU, WTFM, WVIP, WVNJ, WVOX, WWRL.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is David Price, author and artist. Good afternoon, David.
Thank you very much
for coming in again.
It's nice to be back.
Good. Your last visit was, I think, last autumn, wasn't it?
Yes.
2013.
With Tom Benson.
Exactly, a fellow artist. I am just going to briefly give a credit to that. The opening track was actually a track which I've played twice before. And in fact, I played it the first time I ever did a programme on Resonance, which was over 10 years ago when I did a clear spot. And it's called Radio Stations by Aram Saroyan, recorded in Cambridge 1967. And, of course, is just basically him, the poet or author, sort of reading out a list of American radio stations, most of which seem to start with W, 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 W,
yeah,
W.
Yeah, they're all initials and acronyms. And
indeed, which was long before WWW came out.
Yes.
I don't know if there's any and wavelength and whatever.
Interesting.
More W's. Okay, David. Well, again, thank you for coming in. You are an artist and author, experimental author, I suppose I should call you, or an artist author, which makes you different from a conventional novelist or writer as such.
I suppose so, although an experimental writer nonetheless writes one word after the other. Yeah, the way the texts are read and the way they're disseminated is definitely very different.
Right, because you've come at it from an art background.
From an entirely art background.
So you were first of all a practicing artist, or have you always used words?
Not always, although they've always intrigued me. It came a little bit later on in my training as an artist that I really became interested in using language. First, maybe through an interest in typography from a very visual interest.
Right.
And then towards the end of my art school studies, towards the end of my master's degree, in fact, in fine art, I started and eventually finished a PhD that was sort of had one of its feet planted in an English department.
Right.
And that was about art and fiction.
Right.
The presence of art in fiction and the other way around.
Yeah.
And that, I'm giving a very, very brief synopsis of my background. But then,
what would there have been an influential book or text or writer at that time that might have steered you in this direction?
Well, for the PhD dissertation, I was writing almost exclusively about Don DeLillo, the American writer, who.
Oh, that's surprising. I thought you were going to say James Joyce or something.
No,
or Tristram Shandy.
James Joyce was mentioned more than once in the dissertation.
Yeah.
But Don DeLillo's novels have a lot of artists as main characters.
Oh, really? Okay.
Or other kinds of figures that seem to stand in for artists and who produce, as it were, fictitious works. So works by characters almost appear, they're almost exhibited in the books. At least this is what I was arguing.
Right. So there are books within books in Don DeLillo.
Books within books, but also paintings and photographs and films within books.
Right.
And it was this, the bleeding together, bleeding between media that really interested me.
Right. But I have to confess I've never read any Don DeLillo, but he writes sort of in a conventional narrative style?
I wouldn't say he's a kind of an experimental novelist in the mainstream, I suppose.
Okay.
The language is always peculiar and is very sculpted and paired down at moments, excessive at other moments.
Aren't they big hefty books though?
A few of them are hefty, a few of them are very slight.
I'm sure I've seen them on shelves and I always think they sort of look big.
His novel Underworld is enormous,
right?
Certainly, and a few of the others are.
And I made it to films ever?
They have a, I think they have a slightly checkered history of a few of them have been optioned for films but not made. But David Cronenberg did make a film of Cosmopolis.
Right.
That was a more recent one.
Right, right.
Although I must confess that since finishing the dissertation, I haven't read anything by Don DeLillo or even thought about doing so.
All right. But you set out to become an artist and then chose the book as your chosen sort of medium? Or is
I suppose as one of the mediums.
Right.
Although it takes a long time to write a book.
Right.
So,
yes.
You know, there are plenty of other things I make which I'm sure to many viewers might appear to be a more finished object or more cohesive thing, but would have possibly have just taken minutes to make.
Right.
So, amongst other media, I kind of run aground on the kind of rocks of writing.
I mean, I think the only another person who quickly comes to mind is Tom McCarthy.
Yes, a writer I'm very interested in.
I think he started as a conceptual artist, I believe, and then sort of moved into writing, but is now quite successful. I mean, a very successful writer.
Indeed.
I mean, his novels sort of get distributed widely, and you can buy them in Smith's or Foyle's or wherever,
In
normal bookshops, and they get nominated for prizes and so on.
Indeed.
Would you have such similar ambitions to write a straight book that would end up in a bookshop?
I suppose I would, in theory. Mm-hmm. Now you ask the question.
Right.
I mean, the first book that I wrote, which is a novel, which is in front of me on the desk here,
The Fielders.
Yes, is in some ways rather like a straight book. It's odd in places, certainly, and it's a book that will have. The sequel to that book is sort of being written at the moment.
Okay.
So The Fielders leaves in a slightly finishes in a slightly unresolved way.
Right.
That's not a million miles from being a straight book. Most of the things I've written since have been much less so.
Right. I'm trying to think of. I can't think of the word for that style of when you chop things up. It's the word escapes me at the moment. Sort of like displaced narratives or something, or dis. Can you help me?
I'm very interested in displaced narratives.
Right.
Certainly.
In other words, they tend to be. They might be two lines, or a paragraph, or a chunk, or a sentence, which don't necessarily follow on from each other. They're sort of dislocated. Perhaps.
Yes.
Right.
And in some context, or with some projects, I am very interested in kind of. Writing that has a lot of disjunctions or fragmentations in.
Yeah.
The Fielders is sort of, potentially on the face of it, reads like a conventional novel, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the odd things in it, all of the experimental things are, or the intention is at least, that they're sort of buried under a voice that's a little bit like, I'd like to say, something like maybe the less fruity and more descriptive parts of P.G. Woodhouse or something like that.
Right.
So in hopefully a kind of an easy rolling language as a means of disguising odd things.
But the ease is halted by the disconnectedness of it or something.
Hopefully so.
Right.
that's my intention. In any case.
Yeah. And does the idea of distribution or whatever concern you? I mean, coming as you do as an artist to this medium, it seems like you're not at all concerned at the moment with whether these books actually get published and distributed as such.
That's hard to say. I suppose it's not my concern in the way that I'm sure it is for people who have their hearts set on being published authors.
Right.
In some ways, in some ways, it's
which makes it less disappointing.
Perhaps so. I don't know. Right. I mean, in some ways, sort of.
I mean, as an activity, you wouldn't feel bitterly disappointed if the book didn't get taken up by a publisher.
No, that would give me something to write about.
Right.
Whereas it might not for someone who you know, whose intention was really to be read.
Yes.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, you know, ideas of sort of obscurity and, you know, and futility even are interesting things to a writer, obviously.
Yeah.
It would be nice to have a balance between those and
right.
and glorious success, I suppose. But, you know,
yeah.
I'm not so that, overly concerned
okay,
by these things.
So that brings us to well, The Fielders, how many copies were there, do you think, roughly?
The Fielders is published is not quite the right word, but it's distributed by And Publishing, which is exists somewhat within Central St. Martin's.
Right.
And it's, I suppose, a sort of an enterprise to encourage interesting self-publishing. That might be how I'd describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could almost say a kind of curated roster of print-on-demand books.
Right.
Tending to be by people in the art world. So that novel exists.
So are there many people working in this way at the moment?
I think a huge number
of
people.
Is it a movement? Can we call it a movement?
I'm not sure, because it might be a movement that people might not wish to talk about. I think there are a lot of people who... That makes it sound more like a conspiracy than it is. But I think that there are lots of what we would think of as publishing houses who perhaps use print-on-demand means to get themselves the pile of books.
Right.
To then...
Okay.
You know, to then distribute and take to places.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. They're all methods. I find it sort of quite interesting to play with.
Right. And that well, that brings us to this. There is this. There was one book or a book that you produced recently, which I think was on April the 1st.
It was. It was on April the 1st.
Which is that significant?
It's. Fitting, if not
it's
significant.
Fitting. I mean, obviously, it suggests that it might be an April Fool's joke.
Yes.
Was it?
Well, yes and no.
The strategy, I mean.
The things described in it did actually happen. So
right.
In that sense, it wasn't a joke. It does resemble a joke.
Exactly. Tell me about the way this is distributed or not.
Well, this is... In some ways, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Are we?
Because we're talking about thing after...
We can leave that till later if you prefer.
We'll leave the secret half-joke until later, then.
The secret half-joke?
Yeah.
That's going to come later?
Yes.
All right. Fine.
Should we...
Do you want to get on to... Perhaps we should talk about the broadcast, then. Or not.
We can do. Seeing as we've been talking about The Fielders...
Yes.
I could make a little reading from that.
That's fine.
Then we could move on to the radio broadcast.
Absolutely.
How about
okay.
that?
Last time you came on... I intended to ask you to sign my copy of The Fielders.
Oh, yes.
Which I brought with me again. Have you got a pen?
Probably. If I reach over to my bag, I think I have.
Okay, I might have one in my coat. You stay where you are.
Okay, we'll do.
And hang on a sec. I'll just get my pen. And then we can have an on air.
William's reaching towards his coat.
Biro. Here we are. Okay, there's a biro.
Great.
Here's my copy of The Fielders by David Price, first and only edition.
Uh-huh.
David's now looking thoughtful before signing the book.
It's always hard to know what to write. Okay.
The book is being signed on the first fly leaf, or first blank end paper, we might call it. To William and his wavelength, David. Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you for that. So now, please, we could have an extract from the Fielders.
Okay, I'll take a little sip of water and then give a tiny bit of context. The Fielders is, despite a lot of the odd and sometimes contemporary things in it, is a historical novel. It sort of begins in 1917, and it describes the assembly of a group of quite disparate kinds of young people who are artists and authors for the most part, or musicians, and who for one reason or another are not really participating in the First World War.
Hmm.
So it begins with attempting to make a difference to the normal way of writing about the First World War, I suppose. As the book develops, the various characters get gradually assembled into a cricket team, which is called the Assassins CC, the Assassins Cricket Club, which in the end, it transpires, does have some kind of military purpose.
Right.
In the course of this process, there's within the novel, there's a kind of an experimental literary journal called The Twelfth Man. So the chapter that I'm going to read a little from now takes place just at the beginning of a kind of party given in the offices of The Twelfth Man literary journal. And this is when two of the characters who become important meet for the first time. So, I'll begin. Book 6. Coincidences, Defences, Fences, and Tenses. Part 1. And so, at the stated hour, or close to it, the guests of the 12th man begin to arrive. They enter the room containing the display cabinets and glance at them. They look around at each other's costumes, lack of costumes, or clothing that may be one or the other. They accept a drink, mostly poured by Hector and left in a neat grid on a side table, half-filled glasses of white wine. They smoke and begin to talk to each other. Whilst some of the guests can perhaps be passed over without detailed description, they form only the scenery of this party after all, and stand in the background, some slightly more familiar figures cannot. The first of these to arrive is Johnny Four, the musician seen earlier ruminating on the loss of a book on Greek music containing the advertisement in which the 12th man had sought a secretary in the first place. Hector, whose job that became, did not recognise Johnny. She had not seen many of the correspondence of the 12th man in person, of course, so this in itself was not a surprise. However, she was surprised to find herself in the presence of a coloured gentleman. She had not met one before. And what's more, he seemed to be wearing cricket whites. Hello, have you come for the 12th man party? No, I didn't know there was a party. I actually came about the job.
The job?
Yes, there's a secretarial job or something like that. I saw an advertisement. Isn't it rather late in the evening to be coming about a job? And didn't you make an appointment first? You're right. But I was passing and saw lights on from outside. So I thought that maybe the editor, or whoever was in charge, might still be working. Is it you that I should be speaking to? In a sense it is, as I am the secretary of the 12th man. You're too late, I'm afraid. The job's already taken. By me, if you see what I mean. I'm terribly sorry. Would you like a drink? There may not be a job, but there is a party. My name is Hector, by the way. Jean-Jacques. Four. You can call me Johnny, though. And yes, I would like a drink, thank you. You know, I can't help noticing that we both appear to be wearing white. I was just thinking the same thing, Mr. Four. I'm wearing my fencing things. Have you ever fenced? It's probably one of the most tremendous sports or games that I've ever played. I like the way there are a lot of rules, and things beyond the rules that one should or shouldn't do. Conventions. You have to do what is expected of you, in everything but the timing with which you thrust out. Apart from that, almost everything is predetermined. The movements, the actions, I mean. Their execution is reactive, but their nature is already determined. And of course, it's a pleasure to wear white clothing. At least I usually find it is. It's almost reflective. White, I suppose, does reflect light after all, hence the costume of explorers. Or very often, that of the people from the places they explore, like the Bedouin. White robes and scarves across their faces, even the men. I'm not wearing the fencing mask at this moment, as you can see, but earlier on, when I was putting the finishing touches to the preparations of this room, I was wearing it just for fun. Not because I thought that someone was going to stick a blade in my face, which seems quite unlikely, don't you think? Although, you never know when an assassin might strike. Anyway, the point is that it was rather nice to be carrying out very ordinary tasks behind a mask. Expressionless and oval, and meshed, like an insect's eye, as if one's head had just become a single, enormous eye. Look, I'll put the mask on, and you'll see what I mean. Johnny took a polite step back, and watched as Hector pulled the mask from the back of her head and slid it forward onto her face. Once the mesh covered her eyes, it was as if the person inside had retracted into something mechanical, or animal. Or insect, as this girl, what was her name? Hector. As she had said, insect. Johnny looked at the mask, and at the white neck beneath it, bandaged by a stiff collar. The rest of her clothes were thick, about as white as she was, and quilted. He looked at the shape of her body, or was beginning to, when he remembered that behind the grill she must still be there looking at him, unless she had closed her eyes in deference to the giant eye that obscured her face. He looked into the black oval instead. I'll stop at that bit.
Right. Okay.
So there we have it, a small
indeed.
Fragment.
And it's quite an obtuse style, isn't it?
Yes, in some ways.
Does it proceed in a sort? Is there a sort of narrative thread that can be discerned, or I mean, does it sort of, you know, is there a story as such, or is it just a? It sounds like a series of digressions almost. It's constantly moving sideways, isn't it?
The narrator of the book, who gradually becomes almost a character,
almost
a character, does play with the idea that he's digressing from the story all the time,
right?
But there is a certain and a simple narrative in the sense that these young people gradually meet each other and gradually get assembled into a cricket team.
Right.
But they do constantly digress.
And the use of language is supposed to be contemporary with them.
More or less.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah, yeah.
My research for that bit involved sort of reading a certain amount of fiction from that time.
From that period, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, without over elaborate research,
right?
In fact, it's a very fictional history, of this time that's being written, I suppose.
Yeah. All right. Well, that brings us to the broadcasts,
yes,
which is an ongoing project of yours, which is a series of radio broadcasts, which started, I think, in a gallery. As a text designed to be read on the radio, but didn't actually achieve the radio until you came onto this programme, I think. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct,
right?
Yeah.
And you brought that, I think, to the last programme last year with a brand new episode,
yes,
which I think was about 7 or 8 minutes.
A little longer, the
right. And then, in between, you've been to a gallery in Holland.
Well, with the gallery that the original episode was made for, which is the Hidde van Segelen Gallery in Chelsea, what became the third episode of the radio play was made for the booth of this gallery at the Art Rotterdam Art Fair.
Right.
And
the title of that sounds like Rotterdam.
It's the title of that episode was Start Not a Dam!
Right.
Exclamation mark.
Right.
In fact, each
episode sort of refers to where it is, doesn't it? I can't remember what the wavelength one was. The second one was...
Well, that was Nave 10.
Nave
10,
right. Okay.
A-V-E.
Yeah.
And the first episode was Wind Signs. The exhibition that it was a part of the ending to was called Mind Rhymes.
Right.
So each episode sort of rhymes with its place of exhibition.
Exactly. So it has a sort of specific. It specifically relates to the time and place when it is first broadcast.
Yeah. In the case of the previous episodes, the characters who were all recurring characters and recurring actresses, although I think at least one has been added
right,
in each episode, they tend to discuss the situation that their words will be broadcast in.
Right. So you have a cast of characters. I think there's 4 or 5. And are they all women?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
This was in direct response to the exhibition Tom Benson had curated at the gallery. The first place was an exhibition of female artists.
Right.
And so when he asked me sort of vaguely to write or make something for the performance evening,
yeah,
I ended up wanting to, in the form of a radio play, to make a kind of a sort of mirror circumstance to his exhibition. Hence there being a sort of, you know, a cast of female participants.
Yeah.
None of whom are actresses as such,
mm-hmm,
but all of whom I know quite well. And since making the first episode, almost despite myself, I found myself writing for their voices when producing the new scripts.
Right, okay.
The script for the very, very first episode was really written as a text and then almost arbitrarily split into dialogue lines for different characters, then edited a little bit, whereas mm-hmm, the subsequent ones have very much been written for
right,
for the particular voices.
So, and today we're going to hear episode four. At some point, which is called what?
Grave Strength.
Yes. Right. Also rhyming with wavelength. We've
more
had
an
eighth tenth and grave tenth. Grave length.
Yes.
Losing the plot.
Grave strength.
Right. Grave strength. Thank
yes.
you. The episode three, which, how could people hear episode three?
There was a sort of a rather short range radio transmitter hidden within the gallery booth.
Mm.
And then there were sets of headphones hanging from nails that a listener could take, and then within maybe 100-meter radius, could walk around the art fair listening to the radio play, which was looped.
Right.
And that was a rather longer episode. It was, I think, almost 20... It was 18 minutes
right.
long.
Yeah.
and all of the characters spoke more or less one by one in extended monologues.
Yeah.
So that one, for those who took the headphones and walked around for 20 minutes, sort of got a rather in-depth
You can hear that now on the internet, can't you?
I mean,
I listened to it this morning before the program to try and catch up with it. But
anyone
listening to this program will now have to backtrack it if they want to hear. What's your website?
It's davidpricework.org.
Right. So they could catch up with episode three, even if it is after episode four. It might not matter too much.
It probably wouldn't matter too much.
No.
The narratives tend to be reasonably abstract.
Right, indeed. Yes.
Yeah.
They're nice. They do have a mood to them, which I think is important. I mean, I think that's kind of, even if one can't follow the thread or one is left slightly bewildered by who these people are, where they are, what's going on,
There
is a definite mood to it, I think, which is good.
I hope so. I think most of the usual indicators of place and time and mood that are conventionally used in radio drama are used somewhat, it would be wrong to say at random, but used in odd ways in this set of radio plays.
Right.
I mean, sometimes there are the sound of seagulls or of crashing waves,
yeah.
even if that doesn't have any real narrative significance as such. And I think that's, in the case of the fourth episode that we're about to hear, in a way that's even more the case, as there's a certain, I would describe, it's a slightly shorter episode, it's 7.5 minutes.
Mm.
And in some ways it's almost like a kind of a catching up, where the characters, or most of the same characters, get together and find that they have essentially a list of all of the things that I had meant to write about in the previous episode, but hadn't found its way into the script.
Right. Okay.
And they gradually go through this list.
And they're just called A, B, C and D, aren't they, in the narrative in this story?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a radio announcer character.
Yes. Right.
Although she is not present in this fourth episode.
Okay.
And a new cast member is added.
And is it open-ended? Do you know how many episodes, how long might this go on for? Could it go on forever?
It could go on infinitely.
Yeah.
Depending on the patience of the actresses. And
right. Oh, yes.
You know, but it could go on infinitely.
Okay. Well, what do you think? Do you want to play the episode now, or
yes?
Okay,
I think so.
Then. All right.
Shall we go?
I'll let you operate that. It's already
okay.
There, we just need to find it on the.
Grave Strength, a radio play, one way or the other.
The last time we spoke, there were a number of things we forgot to say. A list exists of things that we should have spoken about, but we omitted all of them.
We? I'm not sure that we've met before.
You're right. I'm standing in for someone else. Don't worry, the words will remain the same.
The words can change if you want. Not all of us are here anyway. Next time, I hope we're all there. For the moment, we will rather casually go through this list you mentioned.
One.
Bye.
One. One thing on this list is remembered from a dream.
Two things.
Two things were remembered from dreams.
The first is a word that doesn't exist.
Fignal.
Fignal?
Yes. It's a portmanteau.
A poor coat.
The wearing of a coat.
It was a port, but none of you turned up.
You keep talking about that.
Actually, I'm not that sorry.
Does anyone remember what Fignal means?
No? All right. The next thing on the list is Tuareg Swing.
That must be a kind of music.
I guess so.
That was also remembered from a dream.
What's next?
Typography. Quite general. That could mean anything. There's typography everywhere.
There is language everywhere.
There is language everywhere. Everywhere we look.
Not everywhere.
Impression writing.
Indeed. But listen, we are now back on the radio.
Now?
Yes, as we speak.
As we speak. That was the name of that conversation between the artists, wasn't it? You know...
The one who photographs everything, then lists everything in the photograph.
And the one who... The one whose friend died. They were brilliant.
They were. I loved their work. What's next on the list?
Wait, we started speaking in a pattern. Me, then you, then you, then you. Let's change the order.
How about the reverse order?
Good idea.
I agree.
We all agree.
The face on the wire, or the wire on the face.
What's that?
It must be the name of an artwork, or two possible names for an artwork.
It's also the name of two magazines. One of them doesn't exist anymore. Ah, there's something I've remembered. A video game I used to play. Such a strange atmosphere. It's on the list, too.
What was so strange about its atmosphere?
I don't know. The music was strange. It formed some kind of ideal in my mind. And I tried to find it in other music. It sounded a bit like the music that was playing when we met at the party. You know, kind of medieval. And it had these strange aphorism arguments in it.
Heute habe ich eine lange, scharfe Lektion für Sie.
Und ich habe einen kleinen Tipp für Sie. Verstehen Sie den Punkt?
I don't think it works in that language. How about another?
Una lunga, affilata lezione per voi da imparare oggi.
E un piccolo consiglio per voi. Prendi il punto.
I'm not sure it makes perfect sense either.
All right. We're making progress, I think. We're working our way down the list.
We are. The next thing to talk about is sisters. I don't know what we can say about sisters.
Neither do I.
Nor me.
All right then. There's something I would like to add to the list.
Can you do that?
I think so.
What is it?
Yes, tell us.
It's a conversation I had with a very old woman. She told me about visiting the island of Orkney sometime during the last World War.
Why was she there?
Did she tell you?
What happened there?
She didn't really want to say. She avoided the question. She also told me about a bicycle ride she did around the same time, or maybe earlier. Maybe in the 1930s.
What happened?
Something significant?
Something surprising?
She was passing from one side of the north of England to the other, to meet her brother in a certain town. But at one point, she realized that the pearl necklace around her neck was missing, and she went back to look for it. She estimated, 60 or 70 years later, that it added perhaps 20 miles to her journey.
Interesting.
I actually feel quite uncomfortable when things are put into lists.
Why? I find it quite comforting.
I find it neither comforting or alarming.
Lists have the strength of the grave. The items on a list are caskets.
That's a morbid way to think about things meant as reminders.
Memories are morbid.
Memories are morbid. There's no way around this. But we've gone through most of them. We've more or less cleared the list. We've freed ourselves from all the things we were supposed to have talked about before. We might never need to speak again. Although, I hope we will.
Me too. Grave Strength was performed by Maria Brees, Francisca Nicolaus, and Marta Milanese. Louise Hartman was, sadly, on the other side of the world. Katharina Albrecht was on the correct continent, but had important matters to attend to. Their words will now be remembered by me, Ada Okoye.
Okay, well, that was Grave Strength. The premiere of Grave Strength. It's never been broadcast before.
Not at all.
The previous episode was broadcast at an art gallery in Holland.
Yes, at an art fair.
Episode 2 was broadcast on Wavelength last year.
Was made for this programme, in fact.
Right.
Yes.
And the first episode was broadcast in an art gallery.
It was played through loudspeakers during a performance evening. So it was as it were, broadcast, narrowcast to an audience.
Exactly. I was going to say, yes, narrowcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed, yes. And that's all right for you, the narrowcasting aspect of it? I mean, are you hoping that people will be drawn to it and try and catch up with the previous...
Yes, I think that would be very nice. Mm. Hopefully, even if what narrative there is deliberately rather obscure, but there's nonetheless a sort of an atmosphere and texture.
There is definitely an atmosphere to it, and it's not just the music or the sound effects. There is it's the pace of it, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of pace. When I listened to the episode 3 this morning on my computer, I was sort of looking out of my window, and I could see 3 cranes in the distance, and they were sort of moving slowly, and there was a definite sort of mood created. I felt, I was intrigued to... It takes you out of one's present time or something.
Yes.
I suppose that's what I mean by the mood. You do get drawn into it.
Yeah, and I think that's something which hopefully radio drama is very, very good at.
Yeah.
I mean, radio as a whole is... I mean, evidently a medium that one can listen to whilst the rest of the world is happening.
But it might be the tone of the voices as well. The four characters. They seem to... They're in no hurry to deliver their lines. There's no compulsion. There's no narrative compulsion for them to waver in their sort of, or fluctuate in their tone of voice or what. You know what I mean? It's quite a sort of... there is a calm. Calmness about it, I suppose.
Yeah, in a sense, they are not, or at least I, in a sense, I don't ask them to act.
Right.
Their acting happens naturally in their reading of the text, in their interpretation of the text.
What do they do, the four people, the characters? Are they artists?
They do various things.
Okay, all right, doesn't matter.
All kinds, yeah.
I was just wondering if
all kinds of different things.
All right, okay. And they just... So throughout the text, they're just called A, B, C, and D, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. And in episode 3, they were all supposedly in different ports or harbours.
Well, in the third episode, they discuss the notion of assembling at what they just refer to as a port town.
Right.
In real life, this was Rotterdam.
Rotterdam, okay.
But the third episode was constructed as a set of sort of correspondence.
Okay.
Almost like an epistolary radio play, if that's the right term.
Yeah.
One character writes to the other. The other one has a telephone conversation with another. So they sort of are in contact with each other.
But all the dialogue is written by you.
Yes, yes.
So it's entirely made up dialogue that you have written for them.
Indeed.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And I think that it's... I mean, as the person writing the words, it's a really interesting, kind of an amazing process, in fact, writing in the way that one normally writes, but then knowing that this is destined to be read by a particular voice.
Right.
And it sort of slightly changes the character of the writing.
Right, right.
And slightly removes, in an interesting and nice way, slightly dissolves some of one's responsibility to the text in a strange way. That it means that it can be quite productive to leave little frayed edges, knowing that these things will be dealt with in a certain way by the speaking voice.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Never mind. You're not resolving anything, are you? I mean, it's all left kind of in the air. I mean, it's just there's a sort of...
on the airwaves, indeed. Yes.
Right. Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, maybe we should move on to the hidden book. How should we refer to that? Is it a hidden book?
It is a...
This is the one that was... I referred to earlier as a secret... What did you call it? A secret something or other.
A secret half joke book.
Right. Okay.
If that's the right way of thinking about it. I can explain, well, physically what it is. I'm holding it in front of me.
Yeah.
It's a very small, narrow paperback with a white back cover.
Yeah.
And the front cover, which is white, other than... an elongated scan of a ancient Egyptian sculpture. Scan is of a postcard from the Brooklyn Museum, who we were discussing this a little earlier on, but the shop of the Brooklyn Museum, at least when I last visited, appears to have a policy of keeping postcards until they're sold.
Right.
So in the case of some of these Egyptological ones, there were postcards from the mid-1970s.
Mm.
One of these appears on the cover of this book.
Yeah.
And then on the spine, it says, that's the title, notes made during the preparation of a book. And then the author's name is the author.
Like being yourself.
Being myself, although my name doesn't appear anywhere on this book.
Oh, let me see. Can I see?
Yeah. And it's 70-something pages.
Oh, I see. It just says the author.
Just says the author.
Yes.
Which is the author of the author in The Fielders occasionally refers to the author, himself as the author.
Right.
But this book, Notes Made During the Preparation of a Book,
mm-hmm.
is the essentially and virtually unedited, is the very long, well, what ended up being 20-something thousand words of notes I made during the entire period of writing The Fielders.
Right.
Which at some points is a kind of a pretty mundane diary. It's endless checking with myself how many words certain things are and how long the book is.
Mm.
And also discussing how, as I came to work out how the plot would be, I sort of made a note of it to myself.
So it's like, it sounds a bit like a sort of footnote to The Fielders, but in the form of a separate volume.
Yes, I suppose, yeah.
It takes the place of footnotes, but it should somebody might want to read this after having read The Fielders or at the same time even.
Conceivably, yeah.
Right.
I think to anybody who happened to have enjoyed The Fielders, it would be an interesting curio
yes.
to read.
But the mystery about this book is that you've only made five of them.
Yes.
So far.
Just five copies have been printed. One of which I'm holding now, which is my copy, which is... it's photographed and it's on my artist's website.
Right.
And then the other copies will be sort of surreptitiously placed on the shelves of just a few secondhand bookshops in a couple of countries. One of them is on the shelves of a bookshop somewhere in London. Of course, I can't say where.
A secondhand bookshop?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So it's a very thin book and on the very thin white book. And on the spine, it says, notes made during the preparation of a book. So if one... And you've placed it there, presumably without the bookshop owner's knowledge.
Yes.
So if somebody finds it and goes up to the counter and says they want to buy it, it will be a complete mystery to the owner of the shop.
It'll be a mystery to the owner of the shop, although they will see in it that I've, you know, that I've written a price in pencil.
Have you? How much?
As happens with, I think it's £3.
Fine. I'm sure they'll be glad to sell it and take the £3.
Three extra pounds for them.
Okay.
And then, if such a person came to exist, they would then get to read this book. And they could perhaps work out what book it's in reference to somehow. It's really just placing a kind of a curio into the world. I can read, if you like, the...
Absolutely.
So The book itself is totally unedited, virtually, this entire notes document. The one new thing that was written is the inscription page at the start. So I could read this,
okay,
and then I've prepared a little reading I can make from somewhere in the book, just as an example of how it reads.
Okay.
Okay. The contents of this book do bear reference to the writing of another book. It would be perfectly possible to ascertain the name of that book by making even a cursory reading of this book. It is highly unlikely that the reader of this book would have heard of that book. In fact, it is highly unlikely that there even is a reader of this book. It has not been published as such or distributed in any public way. There are very few copies of it, and these copies have been privately printed. They have been placed surreptitiously on the shelves of a few bookshops favoured by the author in England and elsewhere on the continent of Europe. If you are the reader, and you must be, to be reading these words, then you have been given an unwanted key to a lock that you may not have wished to open. The text that follows is, verbatim, the notes made writing that other book. They have not been edited in any way. Actually, that isn't quite true. There is one thing that I did remove. But I can vouch for the words integrity, if not their honesty. Their author, April the 1st, 2014. So the book begins like this, and then it is simply the diary of
the diary of
writing the book.
Right.
And I could, just as a very, very short preview, read a section that pertains to the character of Johnny, who we...
In the field is.
The field is, who we heard arriving at this party. And there's a point where in the middle of the Fielders, the ninth chapter, in the Fielders, is the ninth chapter of another book. And it's the ninth chapter of a book, you know, written by the character of Johnny.
Right. Okay.
Which is a book of his memories of living in Paris some years earlier on, called The Walls of Paris.
A fictitious book.
A fictitious book.
Within the other book, right.
Within the book.
Okay, fine.
Just that the chapter 9 of The Fielders is, instead, chapter 9 of a fictitious book by a character in The Fielders.
Okay.
The bit of the notes that I'll read quickly now relates to... It simply comes from the moment of me thinking of doing this.
Right.
That's how mundane, in a way, these notes are. Okay. So. This is now the middle of July, as I write. All the notes so far are quite jumbled up, but here is a new thought that I think is worthwhile. At some point, and I guess I had decided it would be the boat journey, he opens up his notebook and looks at a previous text, which then begins and is long. There is Johnny's The Walls of Paris, with Helen of Troy, Paris, etc., etc. Check notebook page in the Moleskine for that. But also, this text is kind of the emotional heart and, the reader might think, and maybe is, the key to the novel, a kind of rationale for the idea of disparate, sudden overlapping people and, I suppose, friendships that pass across the narrator. The narrator is, nominally, the character of Johnny, but this should in some ways hypothesize the model of me being the narrator, seeing all these people going past. This should really be kind of a strong part of the book, a rich world within the world that almost defies the kind of writing that the rest of it represents. It should be warm and honest, an attempt to be perceptive about the emotional currents that run between its characters. In doing so, of course, it can be honest about me, the real me. It can talk about lovers, clandestine desires for those who are not the narrator's lovers, different sorts of friendships, low levels of jealousy and isolation, amongst other emotions, that the narrator is perfectly honest about, at least seemingly. Like Lawrence Durrell, I guess. Durrell describes characters one by one, in some detail, and then traces some interactions between them, seeing how they are plotted, in both the graphical and narrative sense, together. Johnny will write in this way, describing and plotting the characters' inner lives in an emotional way that The Fielders itself occludes, despite having a not dissimilar structural model. The intensity of suddenly struck up friendships, the arrangements to meet a girl for the first time, the gravitational pull of mutual attraction being acknowledged, honest, free writing above all else. Although some of the honest things about me will take place in Johnny's Paris, even though they did not take place in mine, it will be a concentrated place. So, there we have it. It's
right. Okay.
Just a little fragment of my inner thoughts, I suppose.
Right. everything sort of refers to something else all the time, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's almost as though you're never quite in this. It's I think with the episode 3 that I listened to this morning of the other thing, it creates a sort of a bit of a dream space in a way.
Mm-hmm. I think, yes, that's absolutely true.
Where it's, you know, it doesn't matter that it's not quite tangible or doesn't hang together. It's sort of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me that's what writing fundamentally is.
Okay.
And it becomes interesting if that's explicitly acknowledged in the writing.
Right.
Not just so as to sort of point out its own artifice. That's to say, not to be negative about that, but to find quite a lot of richness in the artifice,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, okay, well, we are sort of... We've got about 10 minutes left. Where do you want to go from here? We've got various other texts you might read, or you could play some music from the tracks, you know, that you brought some tracks with you. What would you rather... With the remaining time. You've got various other texts. There's another book there called What Type of Thing?
Yeah. That's one other thing that we could read from.
Which is sort of to do with typography, or started to do with typography?
It's to do with... It's a...
Can I ask you about the medieval music? Is that intended to create a sort of disjunction of time? Or I think you told me once, actually, that's quite... it seems to be quite normal in certain circumstances to play medieval music at parties.
That's something that's claimed in the first episode of the radio play.
Right.
As far as I know, this is not true. I rather wish it was in real life. In the first episode of the radio play,
yeah.
I suppose in the alternative reality East London, let's okay. say, in which yeah. the characters meet.
Yes.
They discuss the fact that it's become fashionable.
Oh, I see. So it's a fictional thing. It doesn't actually, thing. But it might turn out to be true now. People might think that's a good idea.
I think it would be brilliant if it was, yes.
It does work. It's quite clever. I mean, it's quite a night. I can imagine it being quite...
The idea is that in the most fashionable, exciting parties, there would
right.
be medieval music, and also right. people would smoke opium.
Okay. But you just made that up. It's not based on parties you've been to.
Not entirely, no.
No, okay. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to quickly get a... You are listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. And today's guest has been the artist, author, writer, and now broadcaster, David Edward Price. Your website again, David?
DavidPriceWork.org.
Where you can hear episode 3 of... Is there an overall name for the project, for the radio broadcast?
No, it's something I've been thinking about, but there isn't. Each episode
there isn't.
Has
so
a different
they each
title.
Have their own names, even though they lead on one to the other.
Indeed. For the okay. sake of practicality, we should probably come up with one, but
yeah,
we'll see what happens.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming in. And perhaps you'd like to... How would you like to wind up
well,
with this?
I could, seeing as you mentioned medieval... music
okay.
and Renaissance music. There's one thing I'd say about this. It's sort of mentioned or alluded to a little bit mysteriously in Grave Strength, the radio play we listened to earlier on. But one of the characters discusses the fact that there's a certain sort of melodic sensibility in this kind of music that she looks for as an ideal elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
And it's something that reminds her of a particular computer game.
Okay.
And a little fragment of that computer game's music was heard in the radio play.
Right.
And it's true, and that's something that's true of me. There are some various other kinds of music that sort of remind me of this music,
mm-hmm.
all of which sort of form an important musical sensibility in my mind, which I can't quite put my finger on.
Right.
But if we want to, we can... I've brought in a few different examples of this kind of music. We could listen to one of them if
Absolutely.
You wish.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
So
what is it? What are we going to hear? What's the...
Well, we have 5 minutes
at
left.
At least 5 minutes.
At least five
yeah.
minutes, according
well,
to the studio
actually,
clock.
Actually, no more than 5 minutes, yeah, yeah.
So, we'll listen to the shorter one of them,
mm-hmm.
which is the instrumental track Sapphire Mansions by Felt,
mm-hmm.
who are one of my favourite bands.
Right.
Who existed for the duration of the 1980s.
Okay.
And from 1986, they made an instrumental album called Let the Snakes Crinkle Their Heads to Death, which is an extremely short album.
Hmm.
Each track of which is instrumental.
Right.
And it's one of my very favourite albums. So we'll listen to the final song from that called Sapphire Mansions.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'll play that now. Mm-hmm.
You were saying that was Sir Felt?
Yes, and the song Sapphire Mansions.
Right. Reminded me very slightly of The Doors to start with.
Yes, I suppose it is
a little bit like
that.
The organ and the drums,
the
it's kind of similar
round and round and round.
For a while there, but that's just me. That's my sort of thing. All right, so how would you like to end up, David? What should we've got about a minute or something.
We have just a minute. We don't have time to read another text.
No. So we could play another burst of music. And all these music tracks, they relate to the radio plays, don't they?
They relate to the musical sensibility that's described specifically in the episode we heard today.
Right.
And
they
certainly relate as being the background to a lot of the writing.
Yeah. All right. So what should we play out with?
Then we can perhaps leave with the song Lust by Michael Rother.
We've got about 30 seconds.
Let's listen to the first 30 seconds.
Okay.